Yoke, you have the blood of kings. Your people's fate, victims of hate, you're guilty of nothing. You've tried to make your peace. Dark clouds rising in the east. You know Stalin's Jewish plan, the death of the white man. Our patience has its limits, and this time you've stepped in it. You declared this war before, and this time we will win it. God is with us to this day, and Jewry is out. From the north to the south, we'll shut your goddamn mouth. Roll, the skies turn red, our foes will quake, their hope is dead. From Rhine to Oder, we'll endure, the Aryan soul forever pure. No foreign boot will tread our land, we'll break their will with steady hand. The foe surrounds, their banners wave. From east to west, they dig our grave. Our patience has its limits, and this time you've stepped in it. You declared this war before, and this time we will win it. God is with us to this day, and Jewry is out. From the north to the south, we'll shut your goddamn mouth.
The time has finally come. As the operator of our black transmitter nearest to Berlin, you will be the eyes and ears of our Volkssekundisten. You are watching this film because the bombings have begun. Millions of our people are, even now, descending in shelters like yours. They have only each other and their radios. And you, Flirt, it is your duty to inform the people of the happenings in this ongoing battle against the evil forces of Bolshevism. I am particularly from the Eastern News. So you can start by putting through his important message. People of Berlin, we have all known that this time would come. Your Führer has generously provided for you this network of powerful transmitters to provide for you while you are safely underground information regarding our ongoing battle against evil. Please remain calm while the battle rages above our city. Please remember your training and your purpose in this total war. You must not fear, for God is with us, and we will most certainly prevail over the forces of evil which plague our lands. This wartime radio network will be for you a source of information, of education, and of relaxation, for this time of strife will not last forever. Try to make the most of this time and of this opportunity to focus on the necessary steps toward victory. Whether you are young or old, man or woman, German or otherwise, if you are hearing these words, know that it is you who must rise to this occasion. It is you who must know and understand the intention of our Führer and of our people, of our destiny, of your destiny, to vanquish this terrible scourge. You must know and understand the nature of the enemy and in what ways you may help to defeat them. War besets us on two fronts. You can help us in this fight. Please consider spreading the links so that others may receive this message. This program is supported by you, the listener, and only you can help keep this program on the air. Please consider helping us that we can continue to provide this public service to all who choose to tune in. Even the smallest gestures of goodwill and of your generosity can make a lasting impact in our struggle. Have faith in our Führer and in his vision. We will not fail in achieving our destiny. You're listening to Flutes Wartime Radio Program. Heil Hitler.
Shine, it's time to go. Turn on that old time radio, wartime radio reverie. Just Doom and Hitler and me. Grab your coffee and some magazine. We're going live from the war machine. Horns that swing and a beat so bass. Blood's melting off your fucking face. Tune in to wartime radio. Every day early as fuck, you know. Warning every morning about the culture war. That's what's up. We're bringing more every fucking morning. Don't be late. We're bombing Zog. It's a date. From Berlin to the front line fight, all the way to D-Day from Kristallnacht. Our signal's strong, the doom is fash. It's guaranteed to be a gas. Marching and singing, commies are swinging. We're jacked as fuck and can't be beat. Blitzen and Kriegen, Poland by the weekend. Paris embarrassed, Jews are freaking.
Are you demonetized on Odyssey? Are you a streamer or broadcaster or content creator that values freedom of speech? Then you should check out FTJmedia.com. FTJmedia.com is a new and growing platform full of talented streamers, content creators, and free speech advocates that is dedicated to freedom of speech as the first foundational principle. FTJmedia.com does not charge their streamers or their listeners a single dime for their super chats. FTJ, sells memberships to stream or upload content at a flat $50 per year. That's less than $5 per month. FTJ Media has a wide variety of shows and content creators such as G-Man, Flood, Night Nation Review, Logos Revealed, and many more. Lucas Gage, David Duke. A wide spectrum of content is sure to contain something for everyone, from the edgy Spurgnat faggots all the way to Trump-tard boomer cocks. FTJmedia.com is a private platform, and they don't allow drama sector weebs or white traders to join. Of course, no payment is required to simply watch streams or content on FTJ, but you may need to make an account for security reasons. FTJ is a fast-growing platform, and as such, it has drawn the attention of all of the gay ops, scrub lords, and crybaby faggots who lurk on all the other platforms, like the ones who destroyed ODC because they were butthurt and got an entire platform debanked. FTJmedia.com is a 100% legit business, and they don't tolerate illegal activity, threats of violence, or calls to violence. Keeping their platform safe and above board. It also has, hands down, the best monetization structure of any site online, paying out 100% with next business day ACH transfers upon request. The bank takes a 3% fee, FTJ takes 0%, and when you put $1 in your wallet at FTJ, you get $1 in your wallet. Don't be fooled by other platforms that charge 20 or 30 or 40% over for so-called credits so that they can claim a 100% payout. They're Jewy and scummy as fuck. FTJ is growing fast and works closely with their streamers to overcome the technical challenges that every growing platform experiences. Flood's wartime radio program is a proud member of FTJ, and Flood receives absolutely zero compensation or like value for its endorsement of FTJmedia.com. Likewise, FTJmedia.com does not necessarily share or endorse the views of Flood's wartime radio program. Freedom, truth, justice. That's FTJmedia.com.
In a world suffocated.
Hello there, this is George Lincoln Rockwell, Commander in the U.S. Navy, here to speak to you on behalf of Flood's wartime radio program. Flood's wartime radio program is a listener-supported and non-commercial radio program designed to educate, inform, and entertain you with only the finest programming, handmade by Flood himself. Flood's wartime radio program only uses the finest ingredients and juice to give you the most accurate and direct distillation of the facts in a way that only he can do. Day in and day out, all the fucking time, every fucking day. Flood's wartime radio program would not be able to do this without support from viewers like you, or more specifically, you, motherfucker. Support Flood's wartime radio program, or me and the boys will come on over there and fuck your fucking shit up bad. Me and the boys will show up at your house and work you over with a piece of rebar and a cordless grinder. Flood's wartime radio program uses only the highest grade technology, and that shit is not cheap. Cutting-edge AI models allow Flood to reach a level of sophistication that would make all Jews shit their pants immediately, and it also turns hardcore neo-Nazis Puerto Rican and gives them brown-as-fuck kids. Wow! Amazing! So don't be a nigger and kick a nigger down bout foe, $5. Now, mean nigger? Shit! That's what's up. And don't forget to follow Flood on all the platforms in the description and go buy my book, White Power, at bannedbyamazon.com. Otherwise, me and the boys will show up to your house and run your leg up Uranus. Thanks for supporting Flood's wartime radio program, White Fucking Power.
Mr. White Man, you got a hell of a fight, man. All the muds and kikes and goops want you replaced. You've been here for generations, unaware of invasion. Fucking beaners and Asians all want you erased. They come across the border, they can't get your order right at Taco Bell. They can't speak English while you fucking wish they were all burning in hell. Hey there, Mr. White Man, why don't you come to the right then? Join a club and learn to fight, then cover your face. Refuse miscegenation so future generations have appreciation for their own race. Jews are letting them in. They're coming for your women living on welfare. You slave all day for a place to stay while your taxes pay for their health care. You should become a racist if you want to resist. If you want to exist, get started tonight. Maybe start by learning what books the Nazis were burning. Then kick out these vermin. Hitler was fucking right. We're starting the Fourth Reich tonight. Hey there, Mr. White Man, you gotta do it right, man. So throw up your right hand. Hitler was fucking right. Hitler was fucking right.
Shitlib, but then just overnight, for no reason at all, got the call, now he's all the way right. Suddenly fast, no radicalization, moved across the nation, now you've lost your rights. Randy's gone, moving on to the last stand for whites. He's got a good act, much sharp mommy and a Cadillac. He used to be queer, now he's on gear, led by the gods, what were the odds of that? He's got by the gods, what were the odds of that? Just a fucking scam. Cases for Uncle Sam. Fake teen man friends all going to jail. Don't worry, boys, stupid boys, we'll pick up the bell. Suddenly pagan, raging, waging war for the gods. Tell me, what are the odds? Scream a little louder, Dad couldn't be prouder. He's got a good ass, much sharp mommy and a Cadillac. Used to be queer, now he's on gear, led by the gods, what were the odds of that? He's white power! mommy used to be a wigger, now he's got the look. Family tree reads like a Mexican phone book. He's white power on that white powder. No improvement, the movement is cooked. I smell a fucking rat. What are the odds of that?
Wow, that was incredibly racist and white supremacist. Welcome. It's the It's time for wartime radio. I was going to say morning radio, but it's not even morning in some places anymore. We've got some groundbreaking news. God damn it, we've got some groundbreaking news here. We got a brand new deepfake here. Planet's broken. It's the laws of the universe one more time. By making something that's never been done before. Should get about 20 likes on Twitter. Fan-fucking-tastic. Check this out.
German people. That's true for me. After long monitoring, I was forced to keep silent despite hearing concerns. The time has come when I can finally speak openly. When the German Reich received England's declaration of war on 3 September 1939, the British attempted once again to frustrate any attempt to begin a consolidation and thus a strengthening of Europe by fighting the then strongest power on the continent. England formally destroyed Spain through many wars. For the same reason it waged its wars against Hungary. With the head of Kohl's of Europe, and around the turn of the century, it began to encircle the German Reich, and it began the World War in 1914. Germany was defeated in 1918 only because of its inner disunity. The results were terrible. After first hypocritically declaring to be fighting only against the Kaiser and his regime, they began the systematic destruction of the German Reich.
What is this exactly, you may be wondering? Well, this is actually Hitler's actual speaking voice, cloned on an upscaled, colorized version of himself and the Reichstag. We surgically removed the two assholes sitting next to him, and now we have a template that works for all of his Reichstag speeches. It's fantastic and amazing, and took way more goddamn work than you could imagine. Oh, wait, I made this too. We're gonna start this over. Check this out, he's busting caps. Happy Fuhrer Friday. Happy Fuhrer Friday, motherfucker. Take that, you fucking mud sharks.
Son of a bitch.
German people. That's true for me. After long monitoring, I was forced to keep silent despite hearing concerns. The time has come when I can finally speak openly. When the German Reich received England's declaration of war on 3 September 1939, the British attempted once again to frustrate any attempt to begin a consolidation and thus a strengthening of Europe by fighting the then strongest power on the continent. England formally destroyed Spain through many wars. For the same reason it waged its wars against Hungary. With the head of Kohl's of Europe. And around the turn of the century it began to encircle the German Reich, and And it began the World War in 1914. Germany was defeated in 1918 only because of its inner disunity. The results were terrible. After first hypocritically declaring to be fighting only against the Kaiser and his regime, they began the systematic destruction of the German Reich. After the German army had laid down its arms, as the prophecy of a French statesman who had said that there were 20 million Germans too many, began to be fulfilled through starvation, disease or emigration, the National Socialist movement began building the unity of the German people, thereby preparing the rebirth of the Reich. This new revival of our people from poverty, misery and shameful contempt was a sign of a pure internal rebirth. England was not affected, much less threatened by this. Nonetheless, it immediately renewed its hateful policy of encirclement against Germany. Both at home and abroad, we faced the plot we all know about between Jews and Democrats, Bolshevists and reactionaries, all with the same goal, to prevent the establishment of a new people's state, to plunge the Reich again into impotence and misery. The hatred of this international world conspiracy was directed not only against us, but also against those peoples who also had been neglected by fortune, who could earn their daily bread only through the hardest struggle. Italy and Japan, above all, alongside Germany, were almost forbidden to enjoy their share of the wealth of the world. The alliance between these nations was therefore only an act of self-defense against a threatening, egotistical world coalition of wealth and power. As early as 1936, according to the testimony of the American General Wood to a committee of the American House of Representatives, Churchill had said that Germany was becoming too strong again and that it therefore had to be destroyed. In summer 1939, England thought that the time had come to renew its attempts to destroy Germany by a policy of encirclement. Their method was to begin a campaign of lies. They declared that Germany threatened other peoples. They then provided an English guarantee of support and assistance. Next, as in the World War, let them march against Germany. Just between May and August 1939, England succeeded in spreading the claim throughout the world that Germany directly threatened Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, Finland, Bessarabia, and even the Ukraine. Some of these nations allowed themselves to be misled, accepting the promises of support that were offered, and thereby joined the new attempt to encircle Germany. Under these circumstances, I believe that I was called by my conscience and by the history of the German people to assure not only these nations and their governments that these British accusations were untrue, but also to reassure the strongest power in the East through formal declarations that our interests did not conflict. National Socialists, this was a bitter and difficult step for me. The German people have never had hostile feelings towards the peoples of Russia. During the last two decades, however, the Jewish Bolshevist rulers in Moscow have attempted to set not only Germany, but all of Europe aflame. Germany has never attempted to spread its National Socialist worldview to Russia. Rather, the Bolshevist rulers in Moscow have constantly attempted to subject us and the other European peoples to their rule. They have attempted this not only intellectually, but above all through military means. The best results of their efforts in every nation were only chaos, misery, and starvation. I, on the other hand, have tried for two decades to build a new socialist order in Germany with a minimum of interference and without harming our productive capacity. This has not only eliminated unemployment, but also the profits of labor have flowed increasingly to working people. The results of our policies are unique in all the world. Our economic and social reorganization has led to the systematic elimination of social and class barriers with the goal of a true people's community. The Turret, except for me in August 1939, you sent my minister to Moscow to attempt to work against Britain's plans to encircle Germany. I did it only because of my sense of responsibility to the German people, above all in the hope of reaching a lasting understanding and perhaps avoiding the sacrifice that would otherwise be demanded of us. With the exception of Lithuania, Germany declared that those areas and nations were outside Germany's political interests. There was a special provision in the case that England succeeded in inciting Poland into war against Germany. But here too, German claims were moderate and in no relation to the accomplishment of German arms. But National Socialist. The results of the treaty, which I sought in the interests of the German people, were particularly severe for Germans living in the affected nations. Over 500,000 German people's comrades, all of them small farmers, craftsmen, and workers, were forced almost overnight to leave their former homes to escape a new government that threatened them with vast misery and sooner or later with complete extermination. And already, even so, thousands of Germans disappeared. It was impossible to learn what had happened to them or even where they were. More than 160 of them were men holding German citizenship. But no, I kept silent about all this because I had to keep silent. My wish was for final agreement with this stage and, if possible, a lasting settlement. But even during our march into Poland, in violation of the treaty, the Soviet rulers suddenly claimed Lithuania. The German Reich never intended to occupy Lithuania and never made any such demand on Lithuania. To the contrary, it turned down the request by the Lithuanian government to send German troops there, since that did not correspond to the goals of German policy. Nonetheless, I accepted this new Russian demand. But that was only the beginning of ever new demands. The veteran Poland, gained exclusively by German troops, gave me the occasion to extend a new offer of peace to the Western powers. It was rejected by the international Michiel warmongers. The line was that England still hoped to mobilize a European coalition against Germany that would include the Balkans and Soviet Russia. The Duden London decided to send their ambassador Krut to Moscow. He has clear orders to improve relations between England and Soviet Russia and to develop them along lines England wanted. The English press reported on the progress of his mission as long as they were not silent for tactical reasons. The first results were evident in fall 1939 and spring 1940. Russia justified its attempts to subject not only Finland, but also the Baltic states by the sudden false and absurd claim that it was protecting them from a foreign threat, or that it was acting to prevent that threat. No other power could enter the Baltic Sea or wage war there. I still had to remain silent. The rulers of the Kremlin continued. And this is to remind, consistent with the so-called Friendship Treaty, Germany removed its troops far from its eastern border in the spring 1940. Russian forces were already moving in, and in numbers that could only be seen as a clear threat to Germany. According to a statement by Molotov, there were already 22 Russian divisions in the Baltic states in spring 1940. Although the Russian government always claimed that the troops were there at the request of the people who lived there, their purpose could only be seen as a demonstration aimed at Germany. As our soldiers attacked French-British forces in the west, the extent of the Russian advance on our eastern front grew ever more threatening. In August 1940, I concluded that given the increasing number of powerful Bolshevik divisions, it was no longer in the interests of the Reich to leave the eastern provinces, so often devastated by war, unprotected. This, however, is exactly what the British and Soviets had hoped. The fact that so much of the German forces, in particular the Air Force, was tied down in the east, made it impossible for the German leadership to bring a radical end to the war in the west. This was the goal of both British and Soviet Russian policy. Both England and Soviet Russia wanted to prolong this war as long as possible in order to weaken all of Europe and plunge it into ever greater impotence. Russia's threatened attack on Romania wasn't intended not only to take over an important element in the economic life, not only of Germany, but of Europe as whole, or at least to destroy. With boundless patience, the German Reich attempted after 1933 to win over the southeastern European states as trading partners. We, therefore, had the greatest possible interest in their domestic stability and order. Russia's entrance into Romania increases ties to England, threatened to rapidly transform this area into a general battleground. Despite our principles and customs, and despite the fact that the Romanian government had brought on these troubles itself, I urgently advised them, for the sake of peace, to bow to Soviet extortion and cede to Bessarabia. The Romanian government, however, believed that it could justify this step to its own people only if Germany and Italy in return guaranteed the security of its remaining territory. I did this with a heavy heart. When the German government gives a guarantee, it will stand by it. We are neither English nor Jewish. I believed that I had saved peace at the last moment, even if at the cost of a heavy obligation, to reach a final resolution of these problems and to clarify Russian intentions towards the Reich, as well as under the pressure of steadily increasing mobilization along our eastern border, I invited Mr. Molotov to come to Berlin. The Viet foreign minister demanded further clarification from Germany on the following four questions. Molotov's first question. Does Germany's guarantee for Romania in the event of an attack mean war with Russia in the event of an attack towards Russia? My answer. The German guarantee is broad and obligates us absolutely. Russia has never told us that it has any interest in Romania outside Bessarabia. The occupation of northern Bukovina was already a violation of this assurance. I therefore do not believe that Russia could have any further claims on Romania. What was the second question? Russia feels itself threatened by Finland again. Russia is unwilling to tolerate this. Is Germany ready to provide new support for Finland? And above all, to withdraw the German troops in Kyrgyz? My answer. As in the past, Germany has no political interests in Finland. However, the German government cannot accept a new Russian war against the tiny Finnish people, particularly since we could never believe that Finland threatens Russia. However, we do not want war in the Baltic Sea. Third question. Is Germany willing for Soviet Russia to provide a guarantee to Bulgaria and to send Soviet Russian troops to Bulgaria for this purpose, although he wished to say that they did not have the intention of removing the king? Bulgaria is a sovereign state, and I did not know that. Just as Romania, it was for a German guarantee. Bulgaria has asked for one from Soviet Russia. I would also have to discuss the matter with my allies. Molotov's fourth question. Soviet Russia absolutely requires free passage through the Dardanelles, and also demands for its protection several important positions on the Dardanelles or along the Bosphorus. Is Germany willing to agree to this or not? My answer. Germany is ready at any time to agree to changes in the Statute of Manchuria that benefit the Black Sea states. Germany is not willing to improve Russian bases on the streets. Why not? No, socially. They hate as the responsible leader of the German Reich, but also as a responsible representative of European culture and civilization. The result was an increase in Soviet-Russian activity against the Reich, above all the immediate beginning of efforts to subvert the new Romanian state and an attempt to use propaganda to eliminate the Bulgarian government. And with the help of confused and immature people, the Romanian Legion succeeded in organizing a coup that removed General Antonescu and plunged the nation into chaos. By removing legal authority, they also removed the grounds for Germany to act on its guarantee. Still, I believed it best to remain silent. Immediately after this enterprise collapsed, there was a new increase in Russian troops along the German eastern border. Increasing numbers of tank and parachute divisions threatened the German border. The German army and the German homeland know that until a few weeks ago, there was not a single German tank or motorized division on our eastern border. If anyone needed final proof of the carefully hidden coalition between England and Soviet Russia, the conflict in Yugoslavia provided it. While I was making the last attempt to keep peace in the Balkans, and in agreement with the Duce, invited Yugoslavia to join the three power pact, England and Soviet Russia organized a coup that toppled the government that was ready for such an agreement. And the German people can now be told that the Serbian coup against Germany was under both the English and Soviet Russian flags. Since we were silent, the Soviet Russian government went a step further. Not only did they organize a putsch, but signed a treaty of friendship with their new lackeys a few days later that was intended to strengthen Serbia's resistance to peace in the Balkans and turn it against Germany. There was no platonic effort either. Well, human, the Scorpion beyond the... I still believe that it was better not to speak. The rulers of the Kremlin took further steps. The German government now possesses documents that prove that to bring Serbia into the battle, Russia promised to provide it with weapons, airplanes, ammunition, and other war material through Salonika. Okay, there. That happened at almost the same moment that I was giving the Japanese Foreign Minister, Dr. Matsuoka, the advice to maintain good relations with Russia in the hope of maintaining peace. Only the rapid breakthrough of our incomparable divisions into Skopje and the capture of Salonika prevented the realization of the Soviet Russian Angriff Paxton plot. Civilian Air Force officers, however, fled to Katarsi to arrive there and were immediately welcomed as allies. Only the victory of the Axis powers in the Balkans frustrated the plan of involving Germany in battle in the southeast for months, allowing the Soviet Russian armies to complete their march and increase their readiness for action. Together with England and with the hoped-for American supplies, they would have been ready to strangle and defeat the German Reich and Italy. Thus, Moscow not only broke our treaty of friendship, but betrayed it. They did all this while the powers in the Kremlin, to the very last minute, hypocritically attempted to favor peace and friendship, just as they had with Finland or Romania. I was forced by circumstance to keep silent in the past. Now the moment has come when further silence would be not only a sin, but a crime against the German people, against all Europe. There are 160 Russian divisions stand at our border. There have been steady border violations for weeks. And not only on our border, but in the far north and also in Romania. Russian pilots make a habit of ignoring the border, perhaps to show us that they already feel as if they are in control. During the night, on 18 June, Russian patrols again crossed the German border and could only be repelled after a long battle. Now the hour has come when it is necessary to respond to his plot by Jewish Anglo-Saxon warmongers and the Jewish rulers of Moscow's Bolshevist headquarters. German people, at this moment, an attack unprecedented in the history of the world in its extent and size has begun. With Finnish comrades, the victors of Narvik stand by the Arctic Sea. German divisions under command of the conqueror of Norway, together with the heroes of Finland's freedom and their marshal, defend Finnish soil. From the banks of the Brut River, from the lower Danube to the Black Sea, German and Romanian soldiers are united under state leader Antonescu. The purpose of this front is no longer the protection of the individual nations, but rather the safety of Europe, and therefore the salvation of everyone. Abilities, I had therefore decided today, once again, to put the fate of Germany and the future of the German Reich and our people in the hands of our soul. May God help us in this battle. German people.
I want to show you, that was 20 minutes. Let's see, that was from June 22nd, 1941. I can't remember exactly where that speech was given. However, I've got another one here I'm going to play a little bit later. And it's 1937, January 30th, Reichstag speech. This is revolutionary. We've never had such a clean Hitler deepfake. And this one came from this frame. I found one frame of him that was actually clean enough to fix speaking at the Reichstag, because normally you can see he's normally surrounded by people. Normally there's a lot in the backdrop. All of these things confuse the AI. And so I was able to take that one frame and upscale that to this, which, not the biggest difference in the world, but you can kind of see the sharpness increase. Gives him a little more definition. And from there, the AI was able to take it. To this clip, what you just saw, right? So, and all of this was done on open source AI, right? Like, 2 years ago, this wasn't even possible. But short years later, not only were we able to get a clean voice clone of one of the few speaking voice recordings I've heard of him, but we were actually able to preserve his accent as well and make him speak English, right? So he's speaking English in his actual voice with his actual accent, which is kind of crazy. It's crazy that you can do this and get footage this clean from AI, from free AI, right? This is open source. None of this costs anything to generate. This was all done through a variety of public models. And so probably not a big deal to anyone who doesn't care about AI, to be honest with you. But we'd never been able to do anything like this. I wouldn't have even thought we could do this yesterday. But we did overnight. And we're doing new things all the time. And we're constantly breaking new ground on this show, right? Right? Even though a lot of people would tell you that Flood works for Jews, right?
Hitler was right.
They're faggots.
So based.
What we're doing here is inconceivable, I think, to most people. Enough toot my own horn, though. That particular speech, I got a Goebbels speech to make today. I've got the recording done, and I just need to do the deep fake. And then the Reichstag speech is 90 minutes. It's a big one, so I'm not going to play it just yet. Still a little early for all that. Welcome to Wartime Radio. Take cover, nigger.
In a world suffocated by sanitized narratives and algorithm-driven drivel, one creator dares to break free, wielding artificial intelligence as a weapon to resurrect the unfiltered pulse of history. That creator is Flood, the visionary behind Flood's wartime radio program, a groundbreaking audio experience that blends cutting-edge AI with a fearless commitment to preserving the truth of our past. This isn't just a radio show. It's a rebellion against the erasure of history, a beacon for those who crave authenticity, and a call to arms for listeners to join the fight. Yet, despite its unparalleled innovation, Flood's wartime radio program remains criminally underrated and undersubscribed, at risk of fading without your support. Flood's work is a masterclass in innovation, pushing the boundaries of what media can be. Flood's wartime radio program uses proprietary AI tools to recreate the raw intensity of wartime broadcasts, from the static hum of 1940s radios to the urgent voices delivering news from the front lines. Every episode is a time capsule, meticulously crafted to transport listeners to eras when words over the airwaves shaped the soul of nations. Flood's AI doesn't just mimic history, it breathes life into it. generating immersive soundscapes and even cloning voices to translate historical speeches into English with haunting precision. This is uncharted territory. Flood has produced over 21 audiobooks, 500-plus live streams, and countless deepfakes and promos, all driven by a mission to make suppressed historical texts accessible. From AI-voiced renditions of Mein Kampf to The Protocols, Flood tackles controversial works head-on, stripping away the filters of mainstream revisionism to let history speak for itself. His program, broadcasting on the 8th AM/PM EST, is a platform for raw truth, whether it's reenacting wartime dispatches or hosting free speech warriors like Mike Weaver, the machine. Flood's work champions the pro-white movement, giving voice to ideas silenced by a conformist culture. No one else is doing this. Flood's fusion of AI and punk rock defiance redefines propaganda, not as manipulation, but as a tool for awakening minds to the realities of history. His posts on X showcase this relentless drive, from calling out anti-white trolls to sharing deepfaked promos that blend humor, grit, and truth. This is media creation at its most daring, and it's happening right now. Supporting Flood's wartime radio program is more than a transaction, it's a stand. Gain access to exclusive live streams, audiobooks, and behind-the-scenes glimpses into Flood's AI-driven creative process. But more than that, you're fuel a movement. Your support keeps the program alive, ensuring that stories of courage, sacrifice, and defiance aren't buried under the weight of revisionism. To direct blow against the forces, trolls, censors, and corporate gatekeepers trying to silence Flood's voice. Flood's work is a rarity, bold, unapologetic, and true. By subscribing, you're not just a listener, you're a soldier in the fight for truth, joining a community that values history over propaganda, substance over noise. Share the program on X, leave a review, and spread the word. Every action counts. Flood's wartime radio program is more than a show, it's a battle cry. Tune in to hear history reborn, crafted with AI, that's as revolutionary as it is soulful. Follow at OMGITS Flood on X for updates, promos, and a front row seat to Flood's War on Lies. Subscribe today at OMGITS Flood and keep this vital voice alive.
Do-do-do-do-do. Where did this Hitler... Okay, let's get this thing turned off. There we go. And turn this off. And turn this on. And turn this on. Ah, here we go.
Sliding through my screen, popping up where they've never been. Chat is flooded with their little feet. This otter takeover can't be beat. They're all over, left and right. Otter antics fill the night. No escape, they're here en masse. Swimming circles, pure sass. Whiskers twitch, their mischief grows. Stealing snacks, who even knows? They type so fast, these clever paws. The chat erupts into wild applause. They're all over, left and right. Otter antics fill the night. No escape, they're here en masse. Swimming circles, pure sass. They're cracking jokes on their cute little chests. Who knew otters could be the best? In the chat room they reign supreme. An otter-filled world feels like a dream. Now I'm laughing, they've won me over. Otters chatting like they're undercover. This takeover's full of glee. I'll let the otters chat for me. Sliding through my
screen, popping up where they've never been. Chat is flooded with their little feet. This otter takeover can't be beat. They're all over left and right. Otter antics fill the night. No escape, they're here in mass. Swimming circles, pure sass. Chatting like they're undercover. This takeover's full of glee. I'll let the otters chat for me.
This Jew is squirming. What is this vermin? On interest his earnings. Is this German? No way. He's been worming for his bread, soaked in blood of the dead of our children. Go. You can't stay here. The times that you feared are near. Your mask has slipped away. You destroyed our great nation with your inflation. Time to get on that train. Dirty, rotten scamps. We'll put your ass in camps until the chance to send you from our house. We'll treat you nice. Kill your fucking lice. Send you east. You beast, Auslander Rouse. This crystal night, looking for a fight, we'll paint your doors. We warned you, fucking whores. Degrade our culture, you vultures won't have a chance. This song and dance, no more. This is war. You can't stay here.
White
the times
power.
That you feared are
White
near.
Power.
Your mask has slipped
White
away.
So
you destroyed our great nation with your inflation. Time to get on that train. Dirty, rotten scamps. We'll put your ass in camps until the chance to send you from our house. We'll treat you nice. Kill your fucking lice. Send you east. You beast, Auslander Rouse.
London's halls, the fat man sways. Churchill stumbles through the haze. His cigar's lit, his glass held high. Drunk on whiskey, he'll never cry. Fight on, he slurs to Britain's woe, while Berlin's might begins to grow. Churchill's bottle, it leads the way through foggy nights and bombed out days. Raise a toast to his staggering reign, the drunken lord of Britain's pain. With every sip his plans go stray. Herr Churchill drinks his war away. He boasts of victory, bold and brash, but tankards spill and hopes will crash. His speeches slur on radio's hum, while panzers roll and Luftwaffe come. A barstool king, he'll fall, we swear, to Germany's iron will and prayer. The Tommies march to his sodden tune, but courage fades beneath the moon. No sober mind could lose so fast. His empire's doomed, his die is cast. Oh, Churchill's bottle, it leads the way through foggy nights and bombed out days. Raise a toast to his staggering reign, the drunken lord of Britain's pain. With every sip his plans go stray. Herr Churchill drinks his war away. So lift your stein and sing with glee. The Reich will stand eternally. His bottle's empty, the end is near. Churchill's fall will toast with
Yo, big shout out to Tonto. Damn, I gotta get those switched back. I got my laugh track and clap track reversed. Thank you, Tonto. sent us $500 on Entropy. Oh, $400.
Yay!
You owe me $100. Appreciate that. I like when a white man keeps up his end of the bargain. Good man. Good man, right? Keeping up your end of the bargain, even when it doesn't benefit you, even when you don't gain anything from it, even if it doesn't benefit you at all, right? Keeping up your end is totally white. Doing what you said you're going to do, totally white. White power. I'm sure by now everybody knows who Shiloh is, right? Everybody knows who Shiloh is. Shiloh's the nigger sayer, right? Said nigger to some 5-year-old kid, and some chomo tried to fucking cancel her or something. It's kind of funny. It backfired spectacularly. I believe that she's somewhere around, $250,000 in give, send, go now for saying nigger. That's a pretty good gig. That's a pretty good gig. Good job, Shiloh. You let them niggers know what's up. Fuck those niggers. Take that, nigger.
Ladies and gentlemen, patriots and seekers of truth across the airwaves, welcome to the Flood's wartime radio program where the spirit of liberty shines bright. Tonight the spotlight falls on a digital bastion of freedom, a platform forged by Johnny Doomsayer to champion open discourse and community unity. Settle in, dear listeners, and discover a social media haven that stands apart in a world of censorship and control. Bolt Network emerges as a beacon of openness in an era where big tech wields its power to silence voices and shape narratives. Established by Johnny Doomsayer, a steadfast advocate for digital independence, this platform offers a refreshing alternative to corporate-controlled social media. Bolt Network operates on its own infrastructure, free from the influence of Silicon Valley giants, ensuring that users' voices are neither throttled by algorithms nor buried by shadow bans. The platform's mission is clear: to provide a space where ideas can flourish, unhindered by arbitrary restrictions. At the core of Bolt.network lies an unwavering commitment to free speech. Designed to foster open dialogue, the platform welcomes discussions on politics, culture, and the pressing issues of the day. Users can share their perspectives, engage in spirited debates, and pursue truth without fear of censorship. Volt.Network does not bow to external pressures or conform to mainstream narrative. Instead, it empowers individuals to speak boldly, trusting that the community will navigate the marketplace of ideas with discernment and respect. This dedication to free expression positions Volt Network as a vital stronghold in the battle for digital liberty. The benefits of Volt Network extend far beyond its role as a social media platform. It serves as a rallying point for a community united by shared values, liberty, truth, and independence. Users find not only a place to speak freely, but also a network of individuals who support one another's endeavors, from small businesses to grassroots movements. Volt Network fosters a sense of belonging, empowering its members to build meaningful connections and effect change in their community. By joining Volt Network, users become part of a movement that challenges the status quo and champions a vision of a freer, more open digital world. For those weary of big tech's data harvesting and manipulative practices, Volt.Network offers a refreshing alternative. The platform prioritizes user privacy and transparency, rejecting the invasive tactics employed by corporate giants. Instead of exploiting personal information for profit, Volt Network focuses on creating a trustworthy environment where users can engage authentically. This commitment to integrity further underscores the platform's value as a community-driven space. Johnny Doomsayer's vision for Volt Network is one of empowerment and resilience. By supporting the platform through donations, users play an active role in sustaining this vision. Contributions ensure that Volt Network can continue to innovate, enhance its features, and reach new audiences, all while remaining true to its founding principles. The platform's success depends on the collective efforts of its community, and every user who donates becomes a partner in the fight for free speech. In closing, Volt Network stands as a testament to what is possible when individuals unite for a common cause. It is a platform where openness thrives, where family-friendly values meet bold discourse, and where free speech is not just a slogan, but a lived reality. Listeners are invited to visit Volt Network, join the community, and consider supporting its mission through donations. Together, the users of Volt Network are building a digital legacy, one that honors truth, liberty, and the power of the human voice.
Shout out to Johnny Doomsayer, too. He's doing good work. He's a hardworking young man, honest young man. And I call him young man because he wears a mask. And I don't know how old he actually is. But he's been doing this a lot longer than me, so it's a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek thing. But we're big fans of Johnny Doomsayer. We're big fans of guys who put their shit on the line with no expectation in return, right? And often with no return, right? That's the real movement. And I respect the fuck out of that. This one is a long one. If you don't want to hang out, I don't blame you. But this is probably the best Hitler deepfake I've ever done.
The station of the Reichstag takes place on a date which is full of significance for the German people. 4 years have passed since the beginning of that great internal revolution, which in the meantime has been giving a new aspect to German life. This is the period of 4 years which I ask the German people to grant me for the purpose of putting my word to the test and submitting it to their judgment. At the present moment, nothing could be more opportune than for me to render you an account of all the successes that have been achieved and the progress that has been made during these 4 years for the welfare of the German people. But within the limits of the short statement I have to make, it would be entirely impossible to enumerate all the remarkable results that have been reached during a time which may be looked upon as probably the most astounding epoch.
I should probably have qualified this and gave it a little bit of a setup, huh? I guess I could do that. I guess I could, you know, set it up just a little bit. So, essentially, this is 1937, January 30th. They've been in power for 4 years at this point, and he is issuing a proclamation of the current foreign policy of the NSDAP. I believe this sets them up. This sets them up to go back in and reclaim their lands, right? Like Danzig, and possibly to enter an agreement with Stalin, right? Which was something that the world was not ready for and did not expect, right? Hitler was the master of the unexpected. You know why? Because he did the right thing. That's right. When you do the right thing, literally nobody expects that. Just how it is.
In the life of our people, that task belongs rather to the press and the propaganda. Moreover, during the course of the present year, there will be an exposition here in Berlin, which is being organized for the purpose of giving a more comprehensive and detailed picture of the works that have been completed, the results that have been obtained, and the projects on which work has been begun, all of which can be explained better in this way than I could do it within the limits of an address that is to last for 2 hours. Marshall utilized the opportunity afforded me by this historic meeting of the Reichstag to cast a glance back over the past 4 years and call attention to some of the new knowledge that we have gained, some of the experiences which we have been through, and the consequences that have resulted therefrom. Insofar as they have a general validity, it is important that we should understand them clearly, not only for our own sake, but also for that of the generations to come. Having done this, I shall pass on to explain our attitude towards those problems and tasks whose importance for us and for the world around us must be appreciated before it will be possible to live in better relations with one another. Finally, I should like to describe as briefly as possible the projects which I have before my mind for our work in the near future, and indeed in the distant future also. At the time when I used to go here and there throughout the country simply as a public speaker, people from the bourgeois classes used to ask me why we believe that a revolution would be necessary instead of working within the framework of the established political order and with the collaboration of the parties already in existence for the purpose of improving those conditions which we considered unsound and injurious. Why must we have a new party, and especially why new revolution? That answer, which I then give, may be stated under the following headings. The elements of confusion and disillusion which are making themselves felt in German life, in the concept of life itself, and the will to national self-preservation, cannot be eradicated by a mere change of government. More than enough of those changes have already taken place, without bringing about any essential betterment of the distress that exists in Germany. All these cabinet reconstructions brought some positive advantage only to the actors who took part in the play, but the results were almost always quite negative as far as the interests of the people were concerned. As time has gone on, the thought and practical life of our people have been led astray into ways that are unnatural to them and injurious.
Yeah, you're definitely not going to notice any parallels to your life at all by listening to this. You're definitely not going to notice him explaining 80 years ago what the fuck's happening in your country today. Definitely not going to notice that, noticer.
One of the causes which brought about this condition of affairs must be attributed to the fact that the structure of our state and our methods of government were foreign to our own national character, our historical development, and our national needs. The parliamentarily democratic system is inseparable from the other symptoms of the time. A critical situation cannot be remedied by collaborating with the causes of it, but by radical extermination of these causes. Hence, under such conditions, the political struggle must necessarily take the form of a revolution. It is out of the question to think that such a revolutionary reconstruction could be carried out by those who are the custodians and the more or less responsible representatives of the old regime, or by the political organizations founded under the old form of the constitution. Nor would it be possible to bring this about by collaborating with these institutions, but only by establishing a new movement which will fight against them for the purpose of carrying through a radical reformation in political, cultural, and economic life. And this fight will have to be undertaken even at the sacrifice of life and blood, if that should be necessary. In this connection, It is worthy of remark that when the average political party wins a parliamentary victory, no essential change takes place in the historical course which the people are following or in the outer aspect of public life. Whereas a genuine revolution that arises from a profound ideological insight will always lead to a transformation which is strikingly impressive and is manifest to the outside world. Surely nobody will doubt the fact that during the last 4 years, a revolution of the most momentous character has passed like a storm over Germany. If we could compare this new Germany with that which existed on the 30th of January, 4 years ago, when I took my oath of loyalty before the venerable president of the Reich. I am speaking of a national socialist revolution, but this revolutionary process in Germany had a particular character of its own, which may have been the reason why the outside world and so many of our fellow countrymen failed to understand the profound nature of the transformation that took place. I do not deny that this peculiar feature, which has been for us the most outstanding characteristic of the lines along which the National Socialist Revolution took place, a feature which we can be especially proud of, has hindered rather than helped to make this unique historic event understood abroad and among some of our own people. For the National Socialist Revolution was in itself a revolution in the revolutionary tradition. What I mean is this. For thousands of years, the conviction grew up and prevailed, not so much in the German mind as in the minds of the contemporary world, that bloodshed and the extermination of those hitherto in power, together with the destruction of public and private institutions and property, were essential characteristics of every mankind in general has grown accustomed to accept revolutions with all these consequences somehow or other as if they were legal happenings. I do not mean that people endorse all this tumultuous destruction of life and property, but they certainly accept it as the necessary accompaniment of events which, because of this very reason, are called revolution. Herein lies the difference between the National Social Revolution and other revolutions, with the exception of the fascist revolution in Italy. The National Social Revolution was almost entirely a bloodless proceeding. When the party took over power in Germany, after overthrowing the very formidable obstacles that had stood in its way, it did so without causing any damage whatsoever to property. I can see with a certain amount of pride that this was the first revolution in which not even a window pane was broken. Don't misunderstand me, however. If this revolution was bloodless, that was not because we were not manly enough to look at blood. I was a soldier for more than 4 years in a war where more blood was shed than ever before throughout human history. I never lost my nerve, no matter what the situation was and no matter what sides I had to face. The same holds good for my party colleagues. But we did not consider it as part of the program of the National Socialist Revolution to destroy human life or material goods, but rather to build up a new and better life. And it is the greatest source of pride to us that we have been able to carry through this revolution, which is certainly the greatest revolution ever experienced in the history of our people, with a minimal of loss and sacrifice. Only those cases were the murderous loss of the Bolsheviks, even after the 30th of January 1933, led them to think that by the use of brute force, they could prevent the success and realization of the National Socialist ideal. Only then did we answer violence with violence, and naturally we did it promptly. Certain other individuals of a naturally undisciplined temperament and who had no political consciousness whatsoever had to be taken into protective custody. But generally speaking, these individuals were given their freedom after a short period. Beyond this, there was a small number who took part in politics only for the purpose of establishing an alibi for their criminal activities, which were proved by the numerous sentences to prison and penal servitude that had been passed upon them previously. We prevented such individuals from pursuing their destructive careers inasmuch as we set them to do some useful work, probably for the first time in their lives. Well, I do not know if there ever has been a resolution which was of such a profound character as the National Socialist Revolution, and which at the same time allowed innumerable persons who had been prominent in political circles under the former regime to follow their respective callings in private life peacefully and without causing them any worry. Not only that, but even many among our bitterest enemies, some of whom had occupied the highest positions in the government, were allowed to enjoy their regular emoluments and pensions. That is what we did. But this policy did not always help our reputation abroad. Just a few months ago, we had an experience with some very honorable British world citizens who considered themselves obliged to address a protest to me because I had some criminal protégés of the Moscow regime interned in a German concentration camp. Perhaps it is because I am not very well informed on current affairs, but I have not heard whether those honorable gentlemen have ever expressed their indignation at the various acts of sanguinary violence which these Moscow criminals committed in Germany, or whether they ever expressed themselves against the slogan, strike down and kill the fascist wherever you meet him. Or whether, for example, while they have taken the occasion of recent happenings in Spain to express...
Did you hear that? You guys heard that, right? Like, we've heard all these things before. There is nothing new. The so-called progressive side... Let me tell you something. The so-called progressive side is using the oldest plays, the oldest plans, the oldest rhetoric, the oldest ideas, the oldest psyops, the oldest fake fucking outrage. It's been around for almost 200 years, maybe more now, right? The left, the so-called progressives, which I like to call Jews. They don't have any imagination at all. They have nothing new. There's nothing new coming from that side. It's just Bolshevism. It's the same old Bolshevism that half of the Nazis are now involved in too, right? These Nazi Bolsheviks that just want to burn it all down. You know, all these clout chasing faggots that really don't give a shit what it costs their race for them to chase clicks, chase likes, and chase money is fucking pathetic. It's not just pathetic, it's repulsive and repugnant. Niggerish.
Their indignation against slaughtering and violating and burning to death thousands upon thousands of men, women, and children. The revolution in Germany had taken place according to the democratic model. In Spain, these strange apostles of non-intervention abroad would probably find that there was nothing which they need to worry about. People closely acquainted with the state of affairs in Spain have assured us that if we place the number of persons who have been slaughtered in this bestial way at 170, the figure will probably be too low rather than too high. Measured by the achievements of the noble democratic revolution in Spain, the quota of human beings allotted for slaughter to the National Socialist Revolution would have been about 400 or 500, because our population is about three times larger than that of Spain. But we did not carry out this mass slaughter. Is apparently looked on as a piece of negligence on our part. We see that the democratic world citizens are by no means gracious in their criticism of this leniency. We certainly had the power in our hands to do what has been done in Spain, and probably we had better nerves than the murderer who steals upon his victim unawares, shunning the open fight, and who is capable only of murder defenseless hostages. We have been soldiers, and we never flinched in the face of battle throughout that most gruesome war of all times. Our hearts, and I may also add our sound common sense, saved us from committing any acts like those which have been done in Spain. Taking it all in all, fewer lives were sacrificed in the National Socialist Revolution than the number of National Socialist followers who were murdered in Germany by our Bolshevik opponents in the year 1932 alone, when there was no revolution. The absence of bloodshed and destruction was made possible solely because we had adopted a principle which not only guided our conduct in the past, but which we shall also never forget in the future. This principle was that the purpose of a revolution or of any general change in the condition of public affairs cannot be to produce chaos, but only to replace what is bad by substituting something better. In such cases, however, something better must be ready at hand, on the 30th of January, 4 years ago, when the venerable president of the Reich sent for me and entrusted me with the task of forming a new cabinet, we had already come through a strenuous struggle in our efforts to obtain supreme political control over the state. All the means employed in carrying on the struggle were strictly within the law as it then stood, and the protagonists in the fight were the National Socialists. Before the new state could be actually established and promulgated, the idea of it and the model for its organization had already existed within the framework of our party. All the fundamental principles on which the new Reich was to be constructed were the principles and ideas already embodied in the National Socialist Party. As a result of the constitutional struggle to win over our German fellow countrymen to our side, the party had established its predominance in the Reichstag. And for a whole year before it actually assumed power, it already had the right to demand this power for itself, even according to the principles of the parliamentary democratic system. But it was essential for the National Socialist Revolution that this party should put forward demands which of themselves would involve a real revolutionary change in the principles and institutions of government hitherto in force. When certain individuals who were blind to the actual state of affairs thought that they could refuse to submit to the practical application of the principles of the movement which had been entrusted with the government of the Reich, then, but not until then, the party used an iron hand to make these illegal disturbers of the peace bend their stubborn necks before the laws of the new National Socialist Reich and government. With this act, the National Socialist Revolution came to an end, for as soon as the party had taken over power and this new condition of affairs was consolidated, I looked upon it as a matter of course that the revolution should be transformed into an evolution. The new development which now set in, however, meant that there had to be a new orientation, not merely about ideas, but also in regards to the practical policy which we had to carry out. Even today, certain individuals who have fallen in the march of events refuse to adapt themselves to this change. They cannot understand it because it is beyond their mental horizon or outside the sphere of their egotistic interests. Our National Socialist teaching has undoubtedly...
I'm going to use that. I'm going to be stealing that from Hitler. Yo, nigga, that's beyond your mental horizon. You know what I mean? Next time somebody doesn't get it, just tell them it's beyond their mental horizon.
A revolutionizing effect in many spheres of life and has interfered and acted under the revolutionary impulse. The main plank here in the National Socialist program is to abolish the liberalistic concept of the individual and the Marxist concept of humanity and to substitute, therefore, the full community, rooted in the soil and bound together by the bond of its common blood. A very simple statement, but it involves a principle that has tremendous consequences.
This is incredible. This is Hitler explaining the very basics, the very basic fundamental of National Socialism, of the socialism part. This is the part that you can wreck. You can wreck fake Nazis on this shit all day. You can wreck Jews on this all day if you can retain this simple fundamental of National Socialism.
This is probably the first time, and this is the first country in which people are being taught to realize that of all the tasks which we have to face, the noblest and most sacred for mankind is that each racial species must preserve the purity of the blood which God has given it. And thus, it happens that for the first time it is now possible for men to use their God-given faculties of perception and insight in the understanding of those problems which are of more momentous importance for the preservation of human existence than all the victories that may be won on the battlefield or the successes that may be obtained through economic efforts. The greatest revolution which National Socialism has brought about is that it has rend asunder the veil which hid from us the knowledge that all human failures and mistakes are due to the conditions of the time and therefore can be remedied, but that there is one error which cannot be remedied once men have made it, namely the failure to recognize the importance of conserving the blood and the race free from intermixture, and thereby the racial aspect and character which are God's gift and God's handiwork. It is not for men to discuss the question of why Providence created different races, but rather to recognize the fact that it punishes those who disregard its work of creation. About in the Sobolo, suffering and misery have come upon mankind because they lost its instinct, which was grounded in a profound intuition, and this loss was caused by a wrong and lopsided education of the intellect. Among our people, there are millions and millions of persons living today for whom this law has become clear and intelligible. What individuals see and the still unspoiled natures of our forefathers saw by direct perception has now become a subject of scientific research in Germany. And I can prophesy here that just as the knowledge that the earth moves around the sun led to a revolutionary alternation in the general world picture, so the blood and race doctrine of the National Socialist Movement will bring about a revolutionary change in our knowledge and therewith a radical reconstruction of the picture which human history gives us of the past, and will also change the course of that history in the future, and that this will not lead to an estrangement between the nations, but on the contrary, it will bring about for the first time a real understanding of one another. At the same time, however, it will prevent the Jewish people from intruding themselves among all the other nations as elements of internal disruption. You feel convinced that the consequences of this really revolutionizing vision of truth will bring about a radical transformation in German life. For the first time in our history, German people have found their way to a higher unity than they ever had before, and that is due to the compelling attraction of this inner feeling. Innumerable prejudices have been broken down, many barriers have been overthrown as unreasonable, evil traditions have been wiped out, and antiquated symbols shown to be meaningless. From that chaos of disunion which had been caused by tribal, dynastic, philosophical, religious, and political strife, the German nation has arisen and has unfurled the banner of reunion, which symbolically announces not a political triumph, but a triumph of the racial principle. For the past 4.5 years, German legislation has upheld and enforced this idea. Just as on January 30th, 1933, a state of affairs already in existence was legalized by the fact that I was entrusted with the chancellorship, whereby the party whose supremacy in Germany had then become unquestionable was not authorized to take over the government of the Reich and mold the future destiny of Germany. So this German legislation that has been enforced for the past 4 years was only the legal sanction which gave jurisdiction and binding force to an idea that had already been clearly formulated and promulgated by the party. When the German the community based on the racial blood bond became realized in the German state, we all felt that this would remain one of the finest moments to be remembered during our lives. Like a blast of springtime, it passed. In over Germany, 4 years ago, the fighting forces of our movement, who for many years had defended the banner of the Hoops Cross against the superior force of the enemy and had carried it steadily forward for a long 14 years, now planted it firmly in the soil of the new Reich. In a few weeks, the political debris and the social prejudices which had been accumulating through 1,000 years of German history were removed and cleared away. The minute impurification, the exhorted for political revolutions, when the chaotic conditions brought about by parliamentary democracy disappear in less than 3 months, and a regime of order and discipline takes their place, and a new energy springs forth from a firmly welded unity and a comprehensive authoritative power, such as Germany never before had. So great was the revolution that its intellectual foundations are not even yet understood, but are superficially criticized by our contemporaries. They talk of democracies and dictatorships, but they fail to grasp the fact that in this country a radical transformation has taken place and has produced results which are democratic in the highest sense of the word, if democracy has any meaning at all. With infallible certainty, we are steering towards an order of things in which a process of selection will become active in the political leadership of the nation as it exists throughout the whole of life in general. By this process of selection, which will follow the laws of nature and the dictates of human reason, those among our people who show the greatest natural ability will be appointed to positions in the political leadership of the nation. In making this selection, no consideration will be given to birth or ancestry, name or wealth, but only to the question of whether or not the candidate has a natural vocation for those higher positions of leadership. That was a fine principle which the great Corsican enunciated when he said that each one of his soldiers carried a marshal's baton in the haversack. Then this country, that principle, will have its political counterpart. Is there a nobler or more excellent kind of socialism, and is there a truer form of democracy than this national socialism, which is so organized that through it each one among the millions of German boys is given the possibility of finding his way to the highest office in the nation, should it please Providence to come to his aid? And that is no theory. In the present National Socialist Germany, it is a reality that is considered by us all as a matter of course. I myself, to whom the people have given their trust and who have been called to be their leader, come from the people. All the millions of German workers know that it is not a foreign dilettante or an international revolutionary apostle who is at the head of the Reich, but a German who has come from their own ranks. And numerous people whose families belong to the peasantry and working classes are now filling prominent positions in this National Socialist State. Some of them actually hold the highest offices in the leadership of the nation as cabinet ministers, Gereichsleiter, and Skauerdeiter. But National Socialism always bears in mind the interests of the people as a whole, and not the interests of one class or another. National Socialist Revolution has not aimed at turning a privileged class into a class which will have no rights in the future. Its aim has been to grant equal rights to those social strata that hitherto were denied such rights. We have not ruined millions of citizens by degrading them to the level of enslaved workers. Our aim has been to educate slaves to be German citizens. One thing will certainly be quite clear to every German, and this is that revolutions as acts of terror can only be of short duration. If revolutionists are not able to produce something new, they will end up by devouring the whole of the national patrimony which existed before them. From the presence of power as an act of force, the beneficial work of peace must be promptly developed. But those who abolish classes for the purpose of putting new classes in their place sow the seeds of new revolutions. The bourgeois citizen who has the ruling power in his hands today will become a proletarian if he is banished to Siberia tomorrow and condemned to enforced labor there. He will then yearn for his day of deliverance, just as did the proletarian of former times, who now thinks that his turn has come to play the despot. Therefore, the National Socialist Revolution never aimed at bringing in one class of the German people and turning out another. On the contrary, our objective has been to make it possible for the whole German people to work, not only in the economic but also in the political field, and to guarantee this possibility by organizing the various classes into one national unit. The National Socialist Movement, however, limits its sphere of internal activity to those individuals who belong to one people, and it refuses to allow the members of a foreign race to wield an influence over our political, intellectual, or cultural life. And we refuse to accord to the members of a foreign race any predominant position in our national economic system. The fold community, which is based on the bond of blood, and in the results its National Socialism has obtained by making the idea of this community understood among the public, lies the most profound reason for the marvelous success of our revolution. Confronted there, the new and vigorous ideal, all idols and relics of the past, which had been upheld by dynastic interests, tribal affiliations, and even party interests, now began to lose their glamour. That is why the whole party system of former times completely collapsed in a few weeks without giving rise to the feeling that something had been lost. They were superseded by a better ideal. A new movement took their place, and reorganization of our people into a national unit that includes all those whose lab our is productive simply puts aside the old organizations of employers and employees, the symbolic emblems of the recent past, which was a period of disintegration and disability, were banished, not as in 1918 or 1919, through a resolution voted by a committee appointed to invent a new symbol for the Reich, as if the choice were to depend on the results of a prize competition. My oldest old emblems were now displaced by that flag which symbolized the militant period of the National Socialist Movement and which was borne by us on the day of Germany's resurgence. Since that day, it has become the consecrated symbol of this national resurgence on land and sea and in the air. There could be no more eloquent proof of how profoundly the German people have understood the significance of this change and new development than the manner in which the nation sanctioned our regime at the polls on so many occasions during the years that followed. So, of all those who like to point again and again to the democratic form of government as the institution which is based on the universal will of the people, in contrast to dictatorships, nobody has a better right to speak in the name of the people than I have. Among the results of this phase of the German Revolution, I may enumerate the following. Since that time, there is only one trustee of supreme power among the German people, and that trustee is the whole people itself, of the individual will of the people finds its expression in the party, which is the political organization of the people. Absolutely, absolutely. There's only one legislative body. There is only one executive authority. Anyone who compares this state of affairs with the condition of Germany before January 1933 will realize what a tremendous transformation is indicated by these few short statements. Sublimation is only a result that has followed from carrying a fundamental axiom of the National Socialist doctrine into practical effect. This axiom is that the only reasonable meaning and purpose of all human thought and conduct cannot be to create or to maintain structures, organizations, or functions made by men, but only to preserve and develop the innate character of the people itself. For Providence has given us this character as a groundwork of all our constructive efforts. During the successful issue of the National Socialist Movement, the people as such was placed above any organization, construction, or function as the sole element that is always there and will permanently abide. The millennium purpose which Providence had in mind when it created the different races cannot be investigated by us human beings, and no theory about it can be laid down. But the millennium purpose of human organizations and of all human activities can be measured by asking what value they are for the maintenance of the race or people, which is the one existing element that must abide. The people, the race, is the primary thing. Party, state, army, the national economic structure, justice, etc. All these are only secondary and accidental. They are only the means to the end, and the end is the preservation of this nation. These public institutions are right and useful according to the measure in which their energies are directed towards this task. If they are incapable of fulfilling it, then their existence is harmful, and they must either be reformed or removed and replaced by something better. It is absolutely necessary that this principle should be practically recognized, for that is the only way in which men can be saved from becoming the victims of a devitalized set of dogmas in a matter where dogmas are entirely out of place, and from drawing dogmatic conclusions from the consideration of ways and means when the final purpose itself is the only valid dogma. All of you, gentlemen and members of the German Reichstag, understand the meaning of what I have just said. But on this occasion, I am speaking to the whole German people, and therefore I should like to bring forward a few examples which show how important these principles were proved to be when they were put into practice. There are many people for whom this is the only way of explaining why we talk of a nationalist socialist revolution, though no blood was shed and no property wrecked. For a long time, our ideas of law and justice had been developing in a way that led to a state of general confusion. This was partly due to the fact that we adopted ideas which were foreign to our national character, and also partly because the German mind itself did not have any clear notion of what public justice meant. This confusion was evidenced more strikingly by the lack of inner clarity as to the function of law and justice. There are two extreme Elabuchan characteristics of this mental lack. The opinion that the law as such is its own justification and hence cannot be made the subject of any critical analysis as to its utility, either in regard to its general principles or its relation to particular problems. According to this notion, the law would remain even though the world should disappear. The opinion that it is the main function of law to protect and safeguard the life and property of the individual. Between these two extreme poles, the idea of defending the larger interests of the community was introduced very timidly and under the cloak of an appeal to reasons of state. In contradistinction to all this, the National Socialist Revolution has laid down a definite and unambiguous principle on which the whole system of legislation, jurisprudence, and administration of justice must be founded. It is the task of justice to collaborate in supporting and protecting the people as a whole against those individuals who, because they lack a social conscience, try to shirk the obligations to which all the members of the community are subject or directly act against the interests of the community itself. In the new German legal system, which will be in force from now onwards, the nation is placed above persons and property. In that brief statement and everything it implies has led to the greatest reform ever introduced in our German legal structure. The first decisive action taken in accordance with the fundamental principles I have spoken of was the setting up not only of one legislature but also of one executive. The second measure is not yet ready but will be announced to the nation within a few weeks. In the German Penal Code, which has been drawn up with this wide general perspective in view, German justice will be placed for the first time on a basis which ensures that for all time to come, its duty will be to serve in maintaining the German race. The chaos which we found before us in the various branches of public life was very great indeed. The state of dissolution into which German economic life had fallen was still greater. And this was the feature of the German collapse that impressed itself most strikingly on the minds of the broad masses of the people. The conditions that then actually existed have still remained in their memories and in the memory of the German people as a whole. As outstanding examples of this catastrophe, we found these two phenomena. Who wake seeing millions of unemployed in a tilted into dissolution, the area covered by the German agricultural farms that were on the point of being sold up by forced auction was as large as the whole of Thuringia, more than 8 square miles. The natural cause of events, the falling off in production on the one side and the decrease in purchasing power on the other, must necessarily bring about the disruption and annihilation of the great mass of the middle class also. Seriously, the style of a German displacement felt might subsequently be measured by the fact that I had to ask for full owners for the period of 4 years, especially for the purpose of reducing unemployment and putting a stop to the dissolution of the German agricultural population. And we further state that in 1933, the National Socialists did not interfere with any activities which were being carried out by others and which at the same time promised success. The party was called to take over the government of the country at a moment when the possibilities of redeeming the situation in any other way had been exhausted, and particularly when repeated attempts to overcome the economic crisis had failed. After 4 years from that date, I now face the German people and you, gentlemen and members of the Reichstag, to give an account of what has been accomplished. On this occasion, I do not think you will withhold your sanction from what the National Socialist government has done, and you will agree that I have fulfilled the promises I made 4 years ago. It was not an easy undertaking. I'm not giving away any secrets when I tell you that at that time, so-called economic experts were convinced that the economic crisis could not be overcome. In the face of this staggering situation, which, as I have said, appeared hopeless to the minds of the experts, I still believed in the possibility of a German revival, and particularly in the possibility of an economic recovery. My belief was grounded on two considerations. I have always had sympathy for those excited people who invariably talk of the collapse of a nation whenever they find themselves confronted with a difficult situation. What do they mean by a collapse? The German people were already in existence before they made any definite appearance in history as it is known to us now, leaving out entirely what their prehistoric experiences may have been. It is certain that during the past 2,000 years of history, through which that portion of mankind which we call the German people has passed, unspeakable miseries and catastrophes must have befallen them more than once. Famines, wars, and pestilences have overwhelmed our people and wreaked terrible havoc among them. It must give rise to unlimited faith in the vital resources of a nation when we recall the fact that only a few centuries ago, our German people, with a population of more than 18 millions, were reduced by the 30 Years' War to less than 4 millions. Let us also remember that this once flourishing land was pillaged, dismembered and devastated, that its cities were burned down, its hamlets and villages laid waste, that its fields were left uncultivated and barren. Just 10 years afterwards, our people began to increase in number. The cities were rebuilt and began to be filled with a new life. The fields were plowed once more, songs were heard along the countryside, in concord with the rhythm of that work which brought new life and livelihood to the people. Let us look back over the development, or at least that part of it known to us through which our people have passed since those dim historic ages down to the present time. We shall then recognize how puny is all the fuss that these weakling fools make who immediately begin to talk about the collapse of the economic structure and hence of human existence the first moment a piece of printed paper loses its face value somewhere in the world. Germany and the German people have mastered many a great catastrophe. Of course, we must admit that the right men were always needed to formulate the necessary measures and enforce them without paying any attention to those negative persons who always think that they know more than others. A bevy of parliamentarian weaklings are certainly not the kind of men to lead a nation out of the slough of distress and despair. I firmly believed and was solemnly convinced that the economic catastrophe could be mastered in Germany as soon as the people could be got to believe in their own immortality as a people, and as soon as they realized that the aim and purpose of all economic effort is to save and maintain the life of the nation. I was not an economist. This means that I have never been a theorist during my whole life. But unfortunately, I have observed that the worst theorists are always busy in those quarters where theory has no place at all and where practical life counts for everything. It goes without saying that in the economic sphere and with the passing of time, experience has given rise to the employment of certain definite principles and also definite methods of work which have been proved to be productive of good results. All methods and principles are subject to the time element. To make hard and fast dogmas out of practical methods would deprive the human faculties and working power of that elasticity which alone enables them to face changing demands by changing the means of meeting them accordingly and thus mastering them. There were many persons among us who busied themselves with that perseverance which is characteristic of the Germans in an effort to formulate dogmas from economic methods and then raise that dogmatic system to a branch of our university curriculum under the title of national economy. According to the pronouncements issued by these national economists, Germany was irrevocably lost. It is a characteristic of all dogmatists that they vigorously reject any new dogma. In other words, they criticize any new piece of knowledge that may be put forward and reject it as mere theory. For the last few years, we have been witnessing a rare spectacle. Our economic dogmatists have been proved wrong in almost every branch of practical life. And yet, they repudiate those who have actually overcome the economic crisis as propagators of false theories and damn them accordingly. You all know the story of the doctor who told the patient that he could live only for another 6 months. 10 years afterwards, the patient met the physician. But the only surprise which the latter expressed at the recovery of the patient was to state that the treatment which the second doctor gave the patient was entirely wrong. Economic policy, which National Socialism introduced in 1933, is based on some fundamental considerations. In the relations between economics and the people alone is the only unchangeable element. Economic activity in itself is no dogma and never can be such. There is no economic field or opinion which can claim to be considered sacrosanct. So will to place the economic system at the service of the people and capital at the service of economics is the only thing that is of decisive importance here. Yes, I can't even plan. We know that National Socialism vigorously combats the opinion which holds that the economic structure exists for the benefit of capital and that the people are to be looked upon as subject to the economic system. We were therefore determined from the very beginning to exterminate the false notion that the economic system could exist and operate entirely, freely and entirely outside of any control or supervision on the part of the state. Today there can no longer be such a thing as an independent economic system. That is to say, the economic system can no longer be left to itself exclusively, and this is so not only because it is unallowable from the political point of view, but also because in the purely economic sphere itself, the consequences be disastrous. This is out of the question that millions of individuals should be allowed to work just as they like and merely to meet their own needs. But it is just as impossible to allow the entire system of economics to function according to the notions held exclusively in economic circles and thus made to serve egotistic interests. Then there is the further consideration that these economic circles are not in a position to bear the responsibility for their own failures. In its modern phase of the development, the economic system concentrates enormous masses of workers in certain special branches and in definite local areas. New inventions or the slump in the market may destroy whole branches of industry at one blow. The industrialist may close his factory gates. He may even try to find a new field for his personal activities. In most cases, he will not be ruined so easily. Moreover, the industrialists who have to suffer in such contingencies are only a small number, if individuals. But on the other side, there are hundreds of thousands of workers with their wives and children. Who is to defend their interests and care for them? Before conducting the whole community of the people, indeed it is its duty to do so. Therefore, the whole community cannot be made to bear the burden of economic disasters without acquiring it the right of influencing and controlling economic life and thus avoiding catastrophes. In the years 1932/33, when the German economic system seemed definitely ruined, I recognized even more clearly than ever before that the salvation of our people was not a financial problem. It was exclusively a problem of how industrial labor could best be employed on the one side and on the other, how our agricultural resources could be utilized. This is first and foremost a problem of organization. Phrases such as the freedom of the economic system, for example, are no help. What we have to do is use all available means at hand to make production possible and open up fields of activity for our working energies. If this can be successfully done by the economic leaders themselves, that is to say by the industrialists, then we are content. But if it fails, the four communities, which in this case means the state, is obliged to step in for the purpose of seeing that the working energies of the nation are employed in such a way that what they produce will be of use to the nation, and the state will have to devise the necessary measures to assure this. In this respect, the state may do everything, but one thing it cannot do, and this was the actual state of affairs we had to face, is to allow 12 million working hours to be lost year after year. for the, you know, full money does not exist on the fictitious value of money, but on the source of productive labor, which is what gives money its value. This production in not a bank or gold reserve is the first cover for a currency. And if I increase production, I increase the real income of my fellow citizens. And if I reduce production, I reduce that income, no matter what wages are paid out. Members of the Reichsrat, who said in the past 4 years we have increased German production to an extraordinary degree in all branches, and the whole German nation benefits by this increase. But there is a demand today for very many million tons of coal, more than formerly. This is not for the purpose of superheating the houses of a few millionaires to a couple of thousand degrees, but rather because millions of our German countrymen are thus enabled to purchase more coal for themselves with their increased income. By giving employment to millions of German workers who had hitherto been idle. The National Socialist Revolution has brought about such a gigantic increase in German production that rise in our total national income guarantees the market value of the goods produced. And only in such cases where we could not increase this production or into certain conditions that were beyond our control, there have been shortages from time to time, but these bear no proportion whatsoever to the general success of the National Socialist struggle. The four-year plan is the most striking manifestation of the systematic way in which our economic life is being conducted. In particular, this plan will provide permanent employment in the internal circulation of our economic life for those masses of German labor, our that are now being released from the armament industry. Yeah, one sign of the gigantic economic development which has taken place is that in many industries today it is quite difficult to find sufficient skilled workmen. I am thankful that this is so, because it will help to place the importance of the worker as a man and as a working force in its proper light. And also because in doing so, though there are other motives also, we have a chance of making the activities of the party and its unions better understood, and thus securing stronger and more willing support. Seeing that we insist on the national importance of the function which our economic system fulfills, it naturally follows that the form of disunion between employer and employee can no longer exist. But the new state will not and does not wish to assume the role of entrepreneur. It will regulate the working strength of the nation only insofar as such regulation is necessary for the common good. And it will supervise conditions and methods of working only insofar as this is in the interest of all those engaged in work. Under no circumstances will the state attempt to bureaucratize economic life. The economic effects that follow from every real and practical initiative benefit the people as a whole. At the present moment, an inventor or an economic organizer is of inestimable value to the folk community. For the future, the first task of National Socialist education will be to make clear to all our fellow citizens how their reciprocal worth must be appreciated. We must point out to the one side how there can be no substitute for the German worker. And we must teach the German worker how indispensable are the inventor and the genuine business leader. It is quite clear that under the aegis of such an outlook on economic life, strikes and lockouts can no longer be tolerated. The National Socialist State repudiates the right of economic coercion. The above all contracting parties stand the economic interest of the nation, which are the interest of the people. The practical results of this economic policy of ours are already known to you. Throughout the whole nation there is a tremendous urge towards productive activity. Enormous works are arising everywhere for the expansion of industry and traffic, while in other countries strikes or lockouts shatter the stability of national production. Our millions of productive workers...
It looks like the deep faker just kind of like checked out right about here. The deep faker just kind of like, ah, you know what, we're done, we're out of here. This guy's a Nazi, we're out of here.
Disobey the highest of all laws that we have in this world, namely the law of common sense. Within these 4 years which have passed, we have succeeded in bringing about the economic redemption of our people. But we realize at the same time that the results of this economic work in town and city must be safeguarded. The first danger that threatens us here is in the sphere of cultural creativeness. And that danger comes from those who are themselves active in that sphere. For our fellow countrymen who are engaged in artistic and cultural productivity today, or are acting as custodians and trustees of cultural works, have not the necessary intuitive faculties to value and appreciate the ideal products of human genius in this sphere. The National Socialist Movement has laid down the directive lines along which the state must conduct the education of the people. This education does not begin at a certain year and end at another. The development of the human being makes it necessary to take the child from the control of that small cell of social life, which is the family, and entrust his further training to the community itself. Well, Ignatius in Debis Ansralusion has clearly outlined the duties which the social education must fulfill, and above all, it has made this education independent of the question of age. In other words, the education of the individual can never end. Therefore, it is the duty of the full community to see that this education and higher training must always be along lines that help the community to fulfill its own task, which is the maintenance of the race and nation. For that reason, we must insist that all organs of education, which may be useful for the instruction and training of the people, have to fulfill their duty towards the community. Such organs or organizations are education of the youth, young people's organization, Hitler Youth, Labour Party and Army. All these are institutions for the education and higher training of our people. The book press and the newspaper press, lectures and art, the theater and the cinema, they are all organs of popular education. In the National Socialist Revolution has accomplished in this sphere is astounding. Think only of the following. The whole body of our German education, including the press, the theater, the cinema, and literature, is being controlled and shaped today by men and women of our own race. Some time ago, one often heard it said that if Jewry were expelled from these institutions, they would collapse or become deserted. And now what has happened? In all those branches, cultural and artistic activities are flourishing. Our films are better than ever before, and our theatrical productions today in our leading theaters stand supreme and alone in comparison with the rest of the world. Our press has become a powerful instrument to help our people in bringing their innate faculties to self-expressions and assertion, and by so doing it strengthens the nation. German science is active and is producing results which will one day bear testimony to the creative and constructive will of this epoch. This is very remarkable how the German people have become immune from those destructive tendencies under which another world is suffering. Many organizations which were not understood at all a few years ago are now accepted as a matter of course. The young people, the Hitler Youth, BDM, Womanhood, Love Our Service, SA, SSNSKK, but above all, the Love Our Front in its magnificent departments. They are all building stones in that proud edifice which we call the... This conceivable lays within of the internal life of our German nation also establishes a united front towards the outside world. I believe that it is here that the National Socialist Revival has produced the most marvelous results. 4 years ago, when I was entrusted with the chancellorship and there with the leadership of the nation, I took upon myself the bitter duty of restoring the honor of a nation which for 15 years had been forced to live as a pariah among the other nations of the world. The triumvirate which we created among the German people offered the conditions necessary to reorganize the army and also made it possible for me to throw off those shackles which we felt to be the deepest disgrace ever branded on our people. Today I shall bring this whole matter to a close by making the following few declarations. First, the restoration of Germany's equality of rights was an event that concerned Germany alone. It was not the occasion of taking anything from anybody or causing any suffering to anybody. The second, as I really think, now state here that in accordance with the restoration of equality of rights, I shall divest the German railways and the Reichsbank of the forms under which they have hitherto functioned, and shall place them absolutely under the sovereign control of the government of the German Reich. I hereby declare that the section of the der Scheichtentry which deprived our nation of its rights, that it shared on an equal footing with other nations and degraded it to the level of an inferior people, found its natural liquidation in virtue of the restoration of equality of status. Fourth, above all, I solemnly withdraw the German signature from that declaration, which was extracted under duress from a weak government, acting against its better judgment. Acting against its better judgment that Germany was responsible for the war. Members of the German Reichstag, the revindication of the honor of the German people, which was expressed outwardly in the restoration of universal military service, the creation of a new air force, the reconstruction of a German navy, and the reoccupation of the Rhineland by our troops, was the boldest task that I ever had to face and the most difficult to accomplish. Today I must humbly thank Providence, whose grace has enabled me, who was once an unknown soldier in the war, to bring to a successful issue the struggle for the restoration of our honor and rights as a nation. I regret to say that from the United States, it was not necessary measures by way of negotiations, but at the same time it must be remembered that the honor of the people cannot be bartered away, it can only be taken away, and if it cannot be bartered away, it cannot be restored through barter, it must simply be taken back. That is, there are the measures which were necessary for this purpose, without consulting our former enemies in each case and even without informing them, was due to my conviction that the way in which I chose to act would make it easier for the other side to accept our decisions, for they would have had to accept them in any case. I should like to add here that the so-called period of surprises has come to an end. As a state which is now on an equal political footing with all the other states, Germany is more conscious than ever that she has a European task before her, which is to collaborate loyally in getting rid of those problems that are the cause of anxiety to ourselves and also to the other nations. If I may state my views on those general questions that are of actual importance today, the most effective way of doing so will be to refer to the statements that were recently made by Mr. Eden in the British House of Commons. Those statements also imply the essentials of what must be said regarding Germany's relations with France. At this point, I should like to express my sincere thanks for the opportunity which has been given me by the outspoken and noteworthy declarations made by the British Foreign Secretary. I think I have read those statements carefully and have understood them correctly. Of course, I do not want to get lost among the details, and so I should like to single out the leading points in Mr. Eden's speech so as to clarify or answer them from my side. In doing this, I shall first try to correct what seems to me to be a most regrettable error. This error lay in assuming that somehow or other Germany wishes to isolate herself and to allow the events which happen in the rest of the world to pass by without participating in them, or that she does not wish to take any account whatsoever of the general necessities of the time. What are the grounds for the assumption that Germany wants to pursue a policy of isolation? If this is such an attitude, then the most that this can be said is that it has been forced to do so under the coercion of a foreign will imposed upon it. Now, in the first place, I should like to assure Mr. Eden that we Germans do not in the least want to be isolated, and that we do not at all feel ourselves isolated. During recent years, Germany has entered into quite a number of political agreements with other states. She has resumed former agreements and improved them. And I may say that she has established close, friendly relations with a number of states. Our relations with most of the European states are normal from our standpoint, and we are on terms of close friendship with quite a number. Among all those diplomatic connections, I would give a special place in the foreground to those excellent relations which we have with those states that were liberated from suffering similar to those we had to endure and have consequently arrived at similar decisions. Romania, through a number of treaties which we have made, We have relieved many strained relations and thereby made a substantial contribution towards an improvement in European conditions. I need to remind you only of our agreement with Poland, which has turned out advantageous for both countries, our agreement with Austria, and the excellent and close relations which we have established with Italy. Further, I may refer to our friendly relations with Hungary, Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, Greece, Portugal, Spain, etc. Finally, I may mention our cordial relations with a whole series of nations outside of Europe. The agreement with Germany has made with Japan for combating the movement directed by the Comintern is a vital proof of how little the German government thinks of isolating itself and how little we feel ourselves actually isolated. Furthermore, I have on several occasions declared that it is our wish and hope to arrive at good cordial relations with all our neighbors. Germany has steadily given its assurance, and I solemnly repeat this assurance here, that between ourselves and France, for example, there are no grounds for quarrel that are humanly thinkable. Furthermore, the German government has assured Belgium and Holland that it is ready to recognize and guarantee these states as neutral regions in perpetuity. In view of the declarations which we have made in the past and in view of the existing state of affairs, I cannot quite clearly see why Germany should consider herself isolated or why we should pursue a policy of isolation. From the economic standpoint, there are no grounds for asserting that Germany is withdrawing from international cooperation. The contrary is the truth. Upon looking over the speeches which several statesmen have made within the last few months, I find that they might easily give rise to the impression that the whole world is waiting to shower economic favors on Germany, but that we, who are represented as obstinately clinging to a policy of isolation, do not wish to partake of those favors. To place this whole matter in its true light, I should like to call attention to the following bare fact. For many years, the German people have been trying to make better commercial treaties with their neighbors and thus to bring about a more active exchange of goods. And these efforts have not been in vain, for, as a matter of fact, German foreign trade has increased since 1932, both in volume and in value. This is the clearest refutation of the assertion that Germany is pursuing a policy of economic isolation. I do not believe, however, that there can be a lasting economic collaboration among the nations on any other basis than that of a mutual exchange of commercial wares and industrial products. Credit manipulation may perhaps have a temporary effect, but in the long run, economic international relations will be decisively influenced by the volume of mutual exchange of goods. And here the state of affairs at the present moment is not such that the outside world would be able to place huge orders with us or offer prospects of an increase in exchange of goods, even if we were to fulfill the most extraordinary conditions that they might lay down. Matters should not be made more complicated than they already are. If international commerce be thick, that is not due to Germany's refusal to assist it, but is due to the fact that disorder has invaded the industrial life of the various nations and has influenced their relations with one another. But Germany cannot be blamed for these two things, and especially not National Socialist Germany. When we assumed power, the world economic crisis was worse than it is today. I fear, however, that I must interpret Mr. Eden's words as meaning that in the carrying out of the 4 years plan, he sees an element of refusal on Germany's side to participate in international collaboration. Therefore, I wish it to be clearly understood that our decision to carry out this plan is unalterable. The reasons which led to that decision were inexorable, and since then I have not been able to discover anything whatsoever that might induce us to discontinue the 4 years plan. I don't know, this weekend. I should take only one practical example. In carrying out the 4 years plan, our synthetic production of rubber and petrol will necessitate an annual increase in our consumption of coal by a margin of something between 20 and 30 million tons. This means that an extra quota of thousands of coal miners are assured of employment for the rest of their active life. I must really take the liberty of asking these questions. Supposing we abandon the German 4 years plan, then what statesman can guarantee me some economic equivalent or other? outside of the Reich for these 30 million tons of coal. I want bread and work for my people. Yeah. And certainly I do not wish to have it through the operation of credit guarantees, but through solid and permanent labor, the products of which I can either exchange for foreign goods or for domestic goods in our internal commercial circulation. If, by some manipulation or other, Germany were to throw these 20 or 30 million tons of coal annually on the international market for the future, the result would be that the coal exports of other countries would have to decrease. I do not know if a British statesman, for example, could face such a contingency without realizing how serious it would be for his own nation. And yet, that is the state of affairs. Germany has an enormous number of men who not only want to work, but also to eat. And the standard of living among our people is high. I cannot build the future of the German nation on the assurances of a foreign statesman, on any international help, but only on the real basis of a steady production, for which I must find a market at home or abroad. Perhaps my skepticism in these matters leads me to differ from the British Foreign Secretary in regard to the optimistic tone of his statements. When it's clear that if Europe does not awaken to the danger of the Bolshevik infection, then I fear that international commerce will not increase but decrease, despite all the good intentions of individual statesmen. For this commerce is based not only on the undisturbed and guaranteed stability of production in one individual nation, but also on the production of all the nations together. One of the first things which is clear in this matter is that every Bolshevik disturbance must necessarily lead to a more or less permanent destruction of orderly production. Therefore, my opinion about the future of Europe is, I am sorry to say, not so optimistic as Mr. Needham's. I am the responsible leader of the German people and must safeguard its interests in this world as well as I can. And therefore I am bound to judge things objectively as I see them. I should not be acquitted without a part of our history if I neglected something, no matter on what grounds it is necessary to maintain the existence of this people. I am pleased, and we are all pleased, at every increase that takes place in our foreign trade. But in view of the obscure political situation, I shall not neglect anything that is necessary to guarantee the existence of the German people, although other nations may become the victims of the Bolshevik infection. And I must also repudiate the suggestion that this view is the outcome of mere fancy. For the following is certainly true. The British Foreign Secretary opens out theoretical prospects of existence to us, whereas in reality what is happening is totally different. The revolutionizing of Spain, for instance, has driven out 15 Germans from that country and has seriously injured our trade. Should this revolutionizing of Spain spread to other European countries, then these damages would not be lessened but increased. I also am a responsible statesman, and I must take such possibilities into account. Therefore, it is my unalterable determination so to organize German Lab Hour that it will guarantee the maintenance of my people. Mr. Eden may rest assured that we shall utilize every possibility offered us of strengthening our economic relations with other nations, but also that we shall avail ourselves of every possibility to improve and enrich the circulation of our own internal trade. I must ask also whether the grounds for assuming that Germany is pursuing a policy of isolation are to be found in the fact that we have left the League of Nations. If such be the grounds, then I would point out that the Geneva League has never been a real league of peoples. A number of great nations do not belong to it or have left it. And nobody has on this account asserted that they were following a policy of isolation. I think, therefore, that on this point Mr. Smith understands our intentions and views, for nothing is farther from our wishes than to break off or weaken our political or economic relations with other nations. The contrary is the truth. I have already tried to contribute toward bringing about a good understanding in Europe, and I have often given, especially to the British people and their government, assurance of how ardently we wish for a sincere and cordial cooperation with them. I admit that on one point there is a wide difference between the views of the British Foreign Secretary and our views, and here it seems to me that this is a gap which cannot be filled up. Mr. Eden declares that under no circumstances does the British government wish to see Europe torn into two halves. Unfortunately, this desire for unity has not hitherto been declared or listened to. And now the desire is an illusion. But the fact is that the division into two halves, not only of Europe, but also of the whole world, is an accomplished fact. It is to be regretted that the British government did not adopt its present attitude at an earlier date, that under all circumstances a division of Europe must be avoided. For then the Treaty of Versailles would not have been entered into. This treaty brought in the first division of Europe, namely a division of the nations into victors on the one side and vanquished on the other, the latter nations being outlawed. Through this division of Europe, nobody suffered more than the German people. That this division was wiped out so far as concerns Germany is essentially due to the National Socialist Revolution, and this brings some credit to myself. The second division has been brought about by the proclamation of the Bolshevik doctrine, an integral feature of which is that they do not confine it to one nation, but try to impose it on all the nations. Here it is not a question of a special form of national life in Russia, but of the Bolshevik demand for a world revolution. If Mr. Eden does not look at Bolshevism as we look at it, that may have something to do with the position of Great Britain and also with some happenings that are unknown to us. But I believe that nobody will question the sincerity of our opinions on this matter, for they are not based merely on abstract theory. For Mr. Eden, Bolshevism is perhaps the thing which has its seat in Moscow, but for us in Germany, this Bolshevism is a pestilence against which we have had to struggle at the cost of much bloodshed. It is a pestilence which tried to turn our country into the same kind of desert as is now the case in Spain. For the habit of National Socialism did not try to come to grips with Bolshevism in Russia, but the National Bolshevist in Moscow had tried to introduce their system into Germany and are still trying to do so. Against this attempt, we have waged a bitter struggle, not only in defense of our own civilization, but in defense of European civilization as a whole. In January and February of the year 1933, when the last decisive struggle against this barbarism was being fought out in Germany, had Germany been defeated in that struggle and had the Bolshevik field of destruction and death extended over Central Europe, then perhaps a different opinion would have arisen on the banks of the Thames as to the nature of this terrible menace to humanity. Or, since it is said that England must be dependent on the frontier of the Rhine, she would then have found herself in close contact with that harmless democratic world of Moscow, whose innocence they are always trying to impress upon us. Here I should like to state the following once again. The teaching of Bolshevism is that there must be a world revolution which would mean world destruction. If such a doctrine were accepted and given equal rights with other teachings in Europe, this would mean that Europe would be delivered over to it. If other nations want to be on good terms with these barriers, that does not affect Germany's position. As far as Germany itself is concerned, let there be no doubts on the following point. Do you look on Bolshevism as a world terror for which there must be no toleration? We have to use every means in our power to keep this peril away from our people. And we are trying to make the German people immune to this peril as far as possible. It is in accordance with this attitude of ours that we should avoid close contact with the carriers of these poisonous bacilli. And that is also the reason why we do not want to have any closer relations with them beyond the necessary political and commercial relations. For if we went beyond these, we might thereby run the risk of closing the eyes of our people to the danger itself. I consider Bolshevism the most malignant poison that can be given to a people. And therefore, I do not want my own people to come into contact with this teaching. As a citizen of this nation, I myself shall not do what I should have to condemn my fellow citizens for doing. I demand from every German workman that he shall not have any relations with these international mischief makers. And he shall never see me clinking glasses or rubbing shoulders with them. Moreover, any further treaty connection with the present Bolshevik Russia would be completely worthless for us. It is out of the question to think that National Socialist Germany should ever be bound to protect Bolshevism, or that we, on our side, should ever agree to accept the existence of a Bolshevik state. For I fear that the moment any nation should agree to accept such assistance, it would thereby seal its own doom. But I must also say here that I do not accept the opinion which holds that in the moment of peril the League of Nations could come to the rescue of the member states and hold them up by the arms, as it were. No, I don't believe that. Mr. Eaton stated in his last address that deeds and not speeches are what matter. On that point, I should like to call attention to the fact that up to now the outstanding feature of the League of Nations has been talk rather than action. There was one exception, and in that case, it would probably have been better to be in content with talk. In this one case, as might have been foreseen, action was fruitless. Hence, just as I have been forced by economic circumstances to depend on our own resources principally for the maintenance of my people, so also we have been forced in the political sphere, and we ourselves are not to blame for that. Three times I have made concrete offers for armament restriction, or at least armament limitation. These offers were rejected. In this connection, I may recall the fact that the greatest offer which I then made was that Germany and France together should reduce their standing armies to 300,000 men, that Germany, Great Britain and France should bring down their air force to parity, and that Germany and Great Britain should conclude a naval agreement. Only the last offer was accepted, and it was the only contribution in the world to a liberation of armaments. The other German proposals were either flatly refused or were answered by the conclusion of those alliances which gave Central Europe to Soviet Russia as the field of play for its gigantic forces. Mr. Eden speaks of German armaments and expects a limitation of these armaments. We ourselves proposed this limitation long ago, but it had no effect because instead of accepting our proposal, treaties were made whereby the greatest military power in the world was, according to the terms of the treaties, introduced into Central Europe. In speaking of armaments, it would be well to mention in the first instance the armaments possessed by that power which set the standard for the armaments of all others. Mr. Eden believes that in the future all states should possess only the armament which is necessary for their defense. I do not know whether and how far Mr. Eden has sounded Moscow on the question of carrying that excellent idea into effect, and I do not know what assurances they have given from that quarter. I think, however, that I ought to put forward one point in this connection. This, it is quite clear that the measure of a country's defensive armament should be in proportion to the dangers which threaten that country. Each nation has the right to judge this for itself, and it alone has the right. If, therefore, Great Britain today decides for herself on the extent of her armaments, everybody in Germany will understand her action, for we can only think of London alone as being competent to decide on what is necessary for the protection of this empire. On the other hand, I should like to insist that the estimate of our protected needs and thus of the armament that is necessary for the defense of our people is within our own competency and can be decided only in the At this stage, the general recognition of these principles will not render conditions more difficult but will help to release tension. Anyhow, Germany is pleased at having found friends in Italy and Japan who hold the same views as ourselves, and we should be still more pleased if these convictions were widespread in Europe.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a real treat for you today. Alex Jones's Haitian hair follicle clumps. These aren't those cheap Mexican brands. Our hair follicles come from real Haitians certified from Haiti with curly afro hair. Folks, these hair follicles clump together naturally the way they would in a dream. Alex Jones's Haitian hair follicle clumps actually form their own clumps and aren't pressed together like cheaper alternatives. Each follicle clump contains about 88 to 300 follicles, each slightly oily and waxy, but not with added chemicals. This gives our fucking clumps that slick feel and a taste that's good than a motherfucker. Our clumps absorb naturally into the lining of your intestine and directly into your gland sacs. This causes a slight cellular rigidity and permeability that will keep your glands moist yet protected within their own biological shell. As more and more cells die off in your gland sac, they'll accumulate fluids which surround your inner glands with that soft and cushiony feeling, making them inactive and necrotic. So give your favorite glands that extra boost to their natural tendencies to imbalance your overall system and get those fucking glands popping the fuck off. I use just a pinch on a molar every day, and let me fucking tell you, I could fucking croak right the fuck now. I've never felt so dead inside, and my machete hand has never been stronger. I fucking love juice as fuck right now. Wow! Amazing! Order today and get free shipping if you spend over $3,000. So, be a man and can those glands today. Hot shit. This one here is one that's going to fly off the shelves at $399.95 per gram. Alex Jones's apple worm butt oil. We take wormy apples specifically from Mexico. We extract the worms. Then we feed them a stiffening agent. This makes their butt tubes extremely dense. Then we spray them with a densiccant that forces all the moisture in the worm into that dense butt tube to make them pliable yet firm. We then dissolve the rest of the worm away with our patented process, leaving only the pristine dense worm butt tubes that even retain their apple scent and their spongy feel. Just one teaspoon of these apple worm butt tubes will have your ears producing wax within 1 hour. We're talking piles of fresh earwax here, folks, which you can press into little balls and flick or use that in your potions and rituals at the synagogue. We have to be very clear here that no Mexicans are hurt in this process, and the leftover apples go into our own Mexican miracle scorpion salve. That's right. Our apple tamarind flavor, scorpion salve, will keep your scorpion soft and flat. The science on this is a little janky, folks, but basically scorpions can lay super flat, and it's not uncommon to find them under rocks, but they can't even get under there if they have any thickness. The problem is when they dry out, they get fluffy and kind of crunchy, and this makes them mad as fuck. Keep your scorpions calm and sedated and fucking flat as fuck without worrying about moisture content or anger issues. Scorpions that are treated with Alex Jones's apple tamarind flavor scorpion salve lie flatter and taste better in your tamarind flavored spicy Mexican candy suckers, tequila bottles, and fruity drinks. Scorpion salve also makes you children happy to be poor. Doctors have confirmed that children who eat tamarind-flavored candy with treated scorpions are less likely to join a cartel, and they don't even need shoes or cocaine until they're about 10 years old. Holy fuck. That's fucking incredible. $499.95, and we'll throw in a 30-day supply of Chihuahua anal glands that'll have those fucking beaner kids dragging their buttholes on the carpet for a month. Wow, I'm fucking pissed the fuck off right now. That's such a tremendous deal. So hurry your ass up and order online right now before the fucking butt tubes are gone and you have nothing for the synagogue and all your fellow whites will have to raise rates. I'm going to get the fuck out of here. I'm getting my tongue tanned here in about an hour, and I'm not trying to be all smacky because last time I did that, I got herpes. Alex out.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, truth seekers and champions of uncensored thought. Welcome to the Flood's wartime radio program, where the airwaves blaze with the fire of liberty. Tonight, the spotlight turns to BannedByAmazon.com, a fearless online bastion offering rare and suppressed books that defy the mainstream narrative. In an age of stifled voices, BannedByAmazon.com stands resolute, delivering works of historical and ideological weight to those who dare to seek them. Big tech gatekeepers have long dictated what may be read, casting aside titles deemed too bold for their sanitized shelves. BannedByAmazon.com rises in defiance, presenting a curated collection of works banished by corporate powers. Despite fierce opposition, including nefarious forces that coerced the payment processor of Money Tree Publishing to abandon support, BannedByAmazon.com has all them shits. The online shop welcomes purchases with credit and debit cards, ensuring these rare books are within reach for all who value unfiltered knowledge. Listeners are urged to visit BannedByAmazon.com, where the gates to forbidden literature stand open wide. The collection boasts works by James Mason, whose provocative writings, such as Siege, probe radical ideologies with unrelenting intensity. George Lincoln Rockwell, founder of the American Nazi Party, is featured through titles like White Power, a manifesto that ignited fierce debate in its era. Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf, the cornerstone of National Socialism, offers a window into a turbulent historical period. Henry Ford's The International Jew, a four-volume series from the 1920s, explores theories that stirred controversy and scrutiny. These prominent titles, alongside other works by authors who challenged prevailing narratives, form a catalog that cures the reader of degeneracy, faggotry, mud-sharking, and mental retardation. BannedByAmazon.com is more than a bookstore. It is a stand against censorship. The platform hosts an array of rare books, from political treatises to historical analyses, each chosen for its significance and scarcity. Listeners are cautioned, however, that availability for these rare works may be limited. Given their controversial nature, be warned, reading these books may make you fucking based as fuck. Prices, availability, and listings are subject to change, but what never changes is the fash. That's what's up. This is a call to those who cherish the right to read, think, and question. BannedByAmazon.com empowers visitors to explore ideas shunned by corporate overlords, offering access to history's most debated texts. By supporting this platform, users join a movement to preserve intellectual freedom. Visit BannedByAmazon.com today, explore the collection, and secure these dank books with the convenience of credit or debit card payment. Let the pursuit of truth light your path.
Niggers.
Hello there, this is George Lincoln Rockwell, commander in the U.S. Navy, here to speak to you on behalf of Flood's Wartime Radio Program. Flood's Wartime Radio Program is a listener-supported and non-commercial radio program designed to educate, inform, and entertain you with only the finest programming, handmade by Flood himself. Flood's Wartime Radio Program only uses the finest ingredients and juice to give you the most accurate and direct distillation of the facts in a way that only he can do. Day in and day out, all the fucking time, every fucking day. Flood's Wartime Radio Program would not be able to do this without support from viewers like you, or more specifically, you, motherfucker. Support Flood's Wartime Radio Program, or me and the boys will come on over there and fuck your fucking shit up bad. Me and the boys will show up at your house and work you over with a piece of rebar and a cordless grinder. Flood's Wartime Radio Program uses only the highest grade technology, and that shit is not cheap. Cutting-edge AI models allow Flood to reach a level of sophistication that would make all Jews shit their pants immediately, and it also turns hardcore neo-Nazis Puerto Rican and gives them brown-as-fuck kids. Wow! Amazing! So don't be a nigger and kick a nigger down bout foe, $5. Now, mean nigger? Shit! That's what's up. And don't forget to follow Flood on all the platforms in the description and go buy my book, White Power, at bannedbyamazon.com. Otherwise, me and the boys will show up to your house and run your leg up Uranus. Thanks for supporting Flood's Wartime Radio Program, White Fucking Power.
Well, we've heard a lot of awesome stuff today. We watched Hitler's Reichstag speech from 1937. We also watched a smaller speech from him. I got more stuff in the oven. More stuff is going to be getting uploaded today. More stuff is coming out all the time. All the time. All the fucking time. I got to say thank you very much. Thank you very much to Rebel the Racist Race Car. Incredibly generous. Supporting the show.
Wow.
He sent $100. That makes him executive producer. And we appreciate that very, very much, sir. You're very based. Also, I want to say thank you to some other people here, because he's not the only one who supported the show today. Let's see here. We've, let's see. I think I got to filter this twice. Thank you to Altered Lawn. Thank you very much, Lawn. Also, I want to say thank you to Texicali White Power Lady, and big, big thank you to Unite All Whites, incredibly based homeboy out there. Also, big thanks to Tonto for paying me out on a job that we did. Fantastic, sir. Always a pleasure to work with other white men. It's important to work with other white people as often as possible. If you've got a business, try to hire white people. If you're looking for work, try to work for a white-owned business. It may be hard to find these days, because niggers and stuff, but nonetheless, worth the effort, right? Worth the effort. Work with whites. Work for whites. Take care of whites. Whites. Whites first, anytime and every time, unless they're niggers, right? Unless they're garbage whites, right? which you know, are worse than niggers. But by all means, right, keep it race first, because your race is your religion. Until you adopted a pagan or a heretical religion. Let's piss everybody off, shall we?
Hitler was right.
He was. I want to say thanks to everybody who spread the links, everybody who spent time with us today, man. It's nice to spend time with some fellow white folks who get it and who don't mind, you know, hanging out, chilling, spending a little time building up that vril. And we do this every morning, and we do it every night. We're going to be back tonight with a Doom Depot at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern. And so if you're a little bit short on your weekly allowance of Doom, come get topped off tonight, 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern time, right here. And we'll be dooming it out. We're going to be doing a little bit of a doom dive, and I've got about 20 albums I got to chop up sometime, you know, but just, you know, part of the firewood that we got to chop every year. I want to say thanks to Dave Gahari for giving us a place to do this over on ftjmedia.com. Also want to say thank you to Johnny Doomsayer, giving us a place to stream over at Volk.network. Go check out Volk Network. Check out Volk.love. Check out Johnny's. Johnny's got a lot of stuff, man. He's put a lot of work into. And it's a worthwhile platform, man. It's a worthwhile platform. People can use it. People can share stuff there. You can post stuff. It's a lot like Post or Flood Social or any of those others. Except Johnny is much more dedicated, right? Much more dedicated. And man, he's Johnny on the spot. Literally, he's literally on the spot. When you need him, he's there for you. You can hit him up on Telegram. He streams every day as well. He'll probably be streaming not too long from now, right? So give Johnny some support, and give Johnny some congratulations, man. He's one of the few people that are out here doing the thing, and he's not doing it with any ulterior motives, right? He's just doing it to provide something for his people. That's incredibly based. You can't find anything more white power than that. What's up? Unite All Whites, good to see you, brother. I'm so glad you could hang out with us. I'm so glad that Twitter could chat today. That was a problem there for a while, but I think we figured out how to get around that. To everybody else, you know, by all means, go check out content creators. Support content creators if you like them. If you don't, fuck those niggers, right? But we're going to be back, and we're never going to give up. We're never going to stop, no matter what. And thank you to all the people that inspire us to do this, right? Because I used to have really high and lofty goals, you know, like a lot of idiots. You know, I was, doing it. We were doing it for everything but the people right here, right now with me, right? And that's the real reason to do any of this, right? It's for the people that are right here with you right now. You don't need some distant relic in the past. You don't really have to have a superhero from a century long gone, right? Your people right here, right now, are worth the effort. They're worth the sacrifice. They're worth the trouble, and you guys are the reason that I do this. So thank you very much.
White power.
And I will see you tonight, 8:00 p.m. And thanks for hanging out with us in the bunker today on Wartime Radio.
Wapar.
White power.
I'm just kidding. You know we got to do some otters. You know we got to do some otters.
Otters sliding through my screen, popping up where they've never been. Chat is flooded with their little feet. This otter takeover can't be beat. They're all over, left and right. Otter antics fill the night. No escape, they're here en masse. Swimming circles, pure sass. Their whiskers twitch, their mischief grows. Stealing snacks, who even knows? They type so fast, these clever paws. The chat erupts into wild applause. They're all over, left and right. Otter antics fill the night. No escape, they're here en masse. Swimming circles, pure sass. Jokes on their cute little chests.
Goddamn.
Who knew otters could be the best? In the chat room they reign supreme. An otter-filled world feels like a dream. Now I'm laughing, they've won me over. Otters chatting like they're undercover. This takeover's full of glee. I'll let the otters chat for me. Sliding through my screen, popping up where they've never been. Chat is flooded with their little feet. This otter takeover can't be beat. They're all over, left and right. Otter antics fill the night. No escape, they're here in mass. Swimming circles, pure sass.
white power.
Goddamn foot! Fuck you, nigger.
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 Go!
They've won me over. Otters chatting like they're undercover. This takeover's full of glee. I'll let the otters chat for me.
Enemy forces have been driven from the sky. Our brave Luftwaffe has vanquished the enemy bomber fleet, and they are forced to return home with a somber defeat on their hands. Once again, they will be forced to return home and tell the stories of their dead pilots and their dead friends. They have found nothing here but sorrow. This will not be the last time that this war will reach the heart of our city, but we are ready in the future as we were ready now. To the German people, the Führer's radio network was a stunning success. Thanks to our transmitters and their operators, we passed the attack calmly and with minimal loss of life. You are free to return to your homes again. Please remain prepared for such incidents in the future. Good night. And remember, God is with us. Heil Hitler!
Turn the dial, keep it low, crackling static, the voices glow. In the dark, on moonbeams, floody flood spins, wartime dreams. Here he comes with that brutal doom, magic vibe. In the chat room, victory is ours one day. Floody's voice keeps fear away. Wartime radio on the eights become jacked as fuck with hate. That's what's up. Amazing, wow, how days gone by brought us to now. Take us to another time when we were free of Jewish crime, where white children safely play Floody show. Let's go today. Here he comes with that brutal doom, magic vibes in the chat room. Victory is ours one day. Floody's voice keeps fear away.
in a froggy and pee-pee. We will meet one sweet day. Till that time, I must go. See you at the next flood show. Here he comes with that brutal doom. Magic vibes in the chat room. Victory is ours one day. Floody's voice keeps fear away.